Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio, and how the tech are ya? You know, folks, I had planned to have a brand new episode come out today, but technical issues got in the way. And yes, I am aware of the irony. And it's one of those irritating things where I haven't yet tracked down the actual source of the problem. So that has taken up a lot of my time today. And it means that I did not get a new episode recorded. However, I would never want to leave you without an episode of Tech Stuff. So here's one that was recorded a few years ago on August 26th, 2019. We published it. It's about Formula One racing. It's called Formula One 101. And on this episode, I had the amazing guest of Scott Benjamin on the show. Miss you, Scott. Hope you are well. And I thought we could go back and listen to this so that we could go fast even while we're sitting still.
Today, we are tackling a listener request. Michael Peachy asked me ages ago if I could talk about Formula One race cars, Formula One racing, what's it all about, how does that work? And I thought, you know, I'm not really a car guy. Like, I've done car topics before, but it requires an enormous amount of research on my part because I don't really know cars. So it's like it's extra work for me. Not that I don't, you know, mind doing some extra work, but that's asking a lot. And then I thought, wait a minute, there's a dude who literally sits on the other side of the table from me at our workstations. His name is Scott Benjamin, and he's not doing anything, so I'm just going to grab him and pull him into the studio. Scott, welcome to the show!
Did you just say not doing anything?
Okay, that's totally a lie. Scott's doing a lot of stuff.
I'm doing some stuff over there, yeah, now and then.
So Scott, first of all, tell our listeners what you have been doing because they may not be aware of the shows you're working on.
All right. Well, first, thank you for having me on your show.
You
I really
are
appreciate it. Every time I'm here, I have a good time. So let's keep that up, okay?
How about absolutely.
That? 100% on this.
Yes.
And I've been working on some other stuff. I've been gosh, for a couple of years, I've been doing some true crime stuff.
Yeah, you might recognize Scott's voice if you've listened to Monster, for example.
Yeah, Voice of the Zodiac.
Wow.
Yeah, and I've got my own show, which is called Insomniac. I've been doing that, and that one's kind of wrapping up right around now. And I've got a couple of car shows that are coming up soon, and one has already been released. The other one we're kind of holding off on, but it's no secret, I don't think. I mean, we are going to re-release car stuff. I'm going to come back on the show, just myself.
Yeah.
Ben will not be with me, and I'll explain all of that at the beginning of the series.
Yeah.
And there's no big fight or anything like that.
But, Ben and I are always in a big fight, but you and Ben, you're still close.
No. So yeah, we're still tight and everything. He's just got a lot going on right now.
It's
more than a lot of us do. So there's that. And then I also have another show called The Fast Track. And The Fast Track is a lot like car stuff, only it's more focused on things that go fast, people that go fast, ways that we go fast, just components, you know, race series, anything about speed and going quickly and how we can get there faster. And that's what it's all about.
Awesome. So you are clearly the go-to guy if we're going to talk about Formula One. And in the interest of full disclosure, guys, I was not joking when I say I'm not a car guy, and I'm certainly not a race car guy. I've never really watched racing. I mean, I'm aware of it from the sort of the cultural touchstones that are out there. And, I'm aware that there are different kinds of racing. You know, there's the Formula One, there's stock car racing, you know, there's NASCAR, which is sort of an offshoot of the stock car racing. But beyond that, I wouldn't have necessarily been able to differentiate them. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know much about Formula One before looking back into this, apart from, you know, seeing it in movies and stuff. And I remember joking with you, Scott, this morning. I said, well, to me, the history of race car driving, race cars and races in general, kind of boil back to the day the second car rolled off the manufacturing plant and people started wondering, I wonder which of these two can go faster.
It's essentially true.
Yeah.
I mean, it really did happen that way. I mean, that's what it was. As soon as there were enough cars to get together, they started to race or see who could get to a certain point faster.
Yeah. And a lot of those early races, it wasn't even just about speed. It was because cars were so new. It was literally seeing which one of these can actually make that trip. There were reliability tests, right?
Yeah,
Will this car actually make this trip from – it was almost always Paris to something else. The French were gaga. That's French for wowza for car racing. And in fact, the history of Formula One, if you look at it, really has its roots in an earlier – part of racing, the whole Grand Prix concept, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so we're talking about, you know, turn of the century, turn of the 20th century.
Yeah, and more than 100 years ago.
The early dawn of automobiles is when we're talking about, you know, the racing beginning like you were talking about, you know, when there's just more than a few in a field and they're trying to get somewhere or trying to, you know, prove their endurance by you know, racing 26 miles or whatever it was. You know, it took them all day
to
go that far.
Yeah, because their top speed might be like 15 kilometers an hour.
Yeah, exactly. And the roads and the conditions and the vehicles themselves. And just there's so many factors that go into why these races were just brutal on the person that was, you know, in the driver's seat or in the passenger seat or the mechanic seat or however you want to put it.
Right.
A lot of times, you know, it came down to what the driver could stand. These are open cockpit cars, and they were really, really punishing on the person that was driving.
The wheels were not inflatable tire wheels because first of all, those had not really been invented yet. Also, the roads certainly were not in good enough shape to allow that kind of wheel to last for very long.
No, these are wagon trails.
Yeah. So you're talking about like hard rubber wheels or sometimes like metal wheels on these things. You know, so you can imagine if you've ever been in a bumpy car ride, that's not even coming close to what this experience was like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the tires were not pneumatic tires or by any means. So a lot of times they were a really, really rough ride. But, you know, the racing did begin early in the 20th century. And by the time you get to around, you know, the 1920s, 1930s, things have gotten a lot better. I mean,
yes,
a lot better. We're talking some enormous engines, maybe not the highest horsepower output, but they are strong.
Yeah.
I mean, they're putting aircraft engine in cars at this point.
Wow.
In race cars, I should say, because, you know, they're obviously not a street car. They're something a little bit more than that. They're throwing, you know, V16 engines into cars. And, you know, the manufacturers are starting to get into it, and they're realizing that people are, you know, taking note of The manufacturers that win the race are you know, they're proving that reliability. They're proving their speed. They're proving, you know, just what that they're backing their product. They're throwing it out there for everybody to see. And, of course, that translates to sales. And racing has always translated to sales for automakers. And that's exactly why they get into it. And, you know, early on, you know, we're here to talk about Formula One.
Yeah.
And early on in the days that we're talking about, 1920s, 1930s, there was no Formula One.
Right, right. At this point, you had some – formula in this sense refers to a set of rules.
Yeah.
Right? So you would have different sets of rules for different races, but they changed all the time. And in fact, Formula One rules have changed significantly since they were introduced.
They change weekly, it seems.
To the point where you're like, why are you calling it a formula?
Yeah.
It's kind of like the flavor of the week at this point.
It's a changing formula.
But exactly. It's no Coke Classic. Mm. But the formulas or the rules were usually things like they would govern how heavy your vehicle could be, mm-hmm. and then generally the capacity of the engine. And there were some stretches where even that was thrown out the window. There were the so-called formula libre years, mm-hmm. where that means formula free,
yeah.
right? So you didn't have those restrictions. That really was around 1928 when that happened. And this was also around the same time where to build these race cars was a really expensive endeavor. Mm-hmm. And we'll get into costs, like modern day costs later on, because while it was expensive back then, it was peanuts compared to what it is today.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling, isn't it?
I mean, you've only shared with me a couple of figures. I wanted to save the best for the show because I think you'll hear my jaw hitting the desk multiple times. But the car manufacturers started to pull out around the late 20s, early 30s in order to focus on building out their consumer cars, because that's really when consumer vehicles were starting to take off. And you started seeing the rise of these specialty manufacturers, the Ferraris, the Bugattis, the Maseratis.
And here, there's a couple of interesting things I want to point out about that, about those manufacturers that are stepping in, because, you know, and we should say this too, that, you know, up until this point, it's been called Grand Prix racing.
Yes.
Grand Prix motor racing, I think, is how they actually said it. And Grand Prix, of course, means, I think it means like great prize in French, mm-hmm. right?
So big old honking prize.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Big trophy, right? That's what you win. And so, you know, early days of this type of racing, it was called Grand Prix racing. Mm-hmm. There was no Formula One up until a point that we're going to get to in just a moment here.
Yeah.
But manufacturers were starting to step in that are like Ferrari. Mm-hmm. And Ferrari is a great example, is because he really just wanted to go racing. That's all he wanted to do. He didn't want a road car, and he had to build a certain number of road cars at a certain point in order to fund his racing program. And that's what he did. So he started to
build a car company to fuel his racing addiction.
Exactly. Yeah. So Ferrari, the birth of Ferrari is really because of his desire to go racing. He wanted the best racing machine, but he had to build and sell cars to the public in order to fund that program. And it kind of became this, I don't know what you call it, the way it's kind of this back and forth where, you know, it's like a balancing act.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I build 20 cars this year, I can afford to race one more season.
Mm-hmm.
If I build 80 cars next year, I'll be able to afford another race car and do it for two more seasons or three more seasons or whatever. And it just became this thing that grew and grew and grew. And the teams got bigger, the cars got more expensive and faster, and he was more competitive on the track. And he had to build more street cars, which he didn't really enjoy at first. He didn't want to do that. He just wanted the racing program.
This is fascinating.
I know. And it's crazy, isn't it, that like now when you look at Ferrari, they're a fantastic road car. Of course, they've got a great racing program still.
Yeah.
Of course. I mean, that's what the whole company is based on. But, you know, they do build some incredible street machines as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, they always were great. He was just more doing it, I guess, just out of his own selfish needs, really.
And,
early on, the initial days.
Well, and this also kind of ties in, and we're talking a lot about the pre-Formula One days because it's really important to understand why Formula One came around when it did. In those pre-days, so in the very early years, you had sort of French domination in these races. France was, first of all, France was hosting most of the Grand Prix races and also was fielding at least half the vehicles in most of these races as well. So clearly they were going to dominate. After that, you started to see the rise of the Italian vehicles with the Ferraris coming in and really starting to challenge that. And then following that, you started to see Germany really push hard to get into this space too with German engineering.
Sure.
And this became not just a sports thing, but a political thing, because this, I mean, if you're paying attention, this is the same as the rise of Hitler. And Hitler was very much determined to have Germany's profile raised in all fields of engineering and science, largely as a sort of a domination play. And, you know, we also saw this in the Olympics. We saw it in all – any place where Germany was going to have a place on the world stage, Hitler wanted Germany to be at the very top of that. And so you saw a lot of pressure, a lot of state-sponsored programs in Germany to try and boost their own performance in the racing world. Although I should also add that even state-sponsored only covered part of the cost – of developing these vehicles, because that's how expensive they were. Mm-hmm. You couldn't even have an entire country behind you and still compete. You had to have more money than that.
Sure. And that's why we see teams often come and go in the series. I mean, even now, a lot of teams just simply can't afford to compete. And we're talking about major, major manufacturers. They just don't see enough return on investment a lot of times. And or they may have come into it with only the plan to operate in there for a few years, learn what they can, and then get out.
Yep. So through all this, we get to World War II, mm-hmm. and of course, during World War II, the Grand Prix stop. I mean, obviously, there were more important things going on at that point. Yeah. But as soon as World War II was over, the world started to return to normal. And even before World War II had completely ended in all theaters, it had ended in Europe, they were already starting to plan the next round of Grand Prix, which would take place by 1946. They started holding these races again.
Ah, yes, 1946. Now, 1946 is an important year because I think that was when they held the very first official Formula One race. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, it wasn't actually formalized until 1 year later, I believe, until 1947. And then the first official, I guess if you want to go with like the absolute official world-class, you know, race, world-class Formula One race, the World Championship race was held in 1950, and this was at Silverstone in the United Kingdom.
Yeah. So these were all sort of the stepping stones to establishing what truly would be Formula One, which again, we're going to go more into in our next section after we come back from the break. We're going to talk more about what the Formula One rules were when they were originally put in place. That would obviously change a lot. And I also have some questions for Scott because the rules indicate things like engine volume, and I need to understand more about what that means. And that's why I have him here.
I'll do what I can.
Yeah. No, fortunately, I know a little bit about it, so we can talk about kind of what these are. But these are things that – these are terms that would pop up around racing that, because I was not in that world, to me were just – it was like Greek.
Completely understand.
Just totally a mystery to me. So, yeah, now we finally get up to where you have this organization in Europe that has formalized this set of rules.
This is the FIA.
Yeah, yeah. And so they've got this set now. By the way, if you're wondering, are there other Formula races? Yes, there's Formula 2, there's Formula 3, there's Formula 4. There's also Formula E, mm-hmm. which is for electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk a little bit about the differences largely between Formula One and Formula Two, just on a very brief level in our next segment. But before we get into that, we're going to really dive into some engine stuff in a minute. And I'm going to need to take a quick break to steel myself for this experience. So when we come back, more about Formula One.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted.
Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI. And Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so we get to the point where Formula One rules are set. And here's how I understand the rules to be based on my research. And Scott, if I go way wrong, just, you know, not to use a pun, but steer me back on track.
Okay.
One thing I didn't mention earlier was one of the big differences between Formula One racing and, say, your typical, like, your NASCAR races, mm-hmm. is that the circuits on Formula One involve lots of different turns, left and right, right?
Sure.
That's mm-hmm. not like a big oval like you would see in a lot of race car races.
No, these are road courses.
Yeah.
So there's elevation changes. There are left and right turns, as you said. It's not the high banked ovals like we're talking about in NASCAR or
right.
you know, some other forms of racing.
This is
a challenging race. I mean, they're all challenging, but this becomes a sport where the person behind the wheel really does need to be an athlete. And
yes.
if you don't believe me, try – we talked about this off air, but try going go-karting mm-hmm. at an indoor track for maybe 10, 15 minutes at a time. You're exhausted when you're done.
Yeah, you'll ache.
And that's just go-karting.
And that's just for 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah.
The Formula One race, by the way, has a time limit of 2 hours on a regular race, assuming no red flag conditions pop up.
Yeah. So, you know, no doubt about it, these guys are athletes.
Yeah. And you could experience forces up to 5G in strength, five times the force of gravity on you
yeah.
in some of these turns. And they're taking, like I said, turns left and right. So it is – it also Formula One cars, today's modern ones, which we'll get to a little bit later, go a little faster than the fastest NASCAR cars, like by 5 miles per hour. It's like 200 is the top for NASCAR, generally speaking, and 205 for Formula One. But it's also a very different experience.
It is, yeah. And we're talking about average speeds where, you know, going in a circle, you know, I hate to use that because a lot of people say it's nothing but going in a circle and turning left. It's not that easy.
For
NASCAR.
It's also incredibly brutal.
It is difficult, yeah. Yes. It's more difficult than you would think. But honestly, like, you know, when we're talking about average speeds, I mean, the cars accelerate a lot faster, a lot quicker mm-hmm. than a NASCAR would. And they can brake a lot harder than a NASCAR car would. And mm-hmm. so when you talk about average speeds, you're talking about over the course of a road course versus an oval. It's a significant difference
sure.
in the type of racing that it is.
So some of the basic rules for Formula One when it was first coming out was that originally there was no weight limit on vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
You did have different engine volumes that were allowed. If you were using a turbocharger or supercharger, then you were limited to 1500 cc, mm-hmm. which Scott kindly informed me does not mean carbon copy in this case, but cubic centimeter. We'll get into that in a second.
Sure.
And then I think that you could have up to 3,000 cc for a naturally aspirated engine.
Sure, which means it doesn't have a supercharger, doesn't have a turbo or anything like that. It's just it's breathing air. That's
yes.
it.
So this was something that I actually had to look up because, again, not a car guy. But naturally aspirated means that it's using just the natural atmospheric pressure to feed oxygen into the engine.
That's what I mean. It's not forced induction. When I say it's breathing air, of course, every engine breathes air.
Yeah.
This one is simply just, you're right, it's taking the atmospheric
pressure.
Air. Atmospheric air, I guess. Whereas, if you want to put it that way.
But a turbocharger or a supercharger, it's pushing air into the engine.
It's right? forced air induction is what that is. Yeah, you're using, you're forcing air into the engine. You're creating additional horsepower by ramming more air through there
mm-hmm.
and fuel.
Right. So that means that you're able to get fuel to the cylinders faster. And that's – the cylinders are what we're referring to when we're talking about like 1500 cc. What you're really talking about is the volume that the cylinders can hold based on the full stroke of the piston.
It's the displacement of the engine. So what you're looking at is the amount of space, I guess. I'm going to put this in the simplest way without really getting too much into this. When the pistons travel up and down, if it's all the way at the bottom, there's a you know, in the cylinder itself where the piston travels up and down,
mm-hmm.
there's a volume of air there.
Mm-hmm.
And that air is then, you know, compressed and it's filled with fuel and mm-hmm. that's where the explosion happens and
right.
powers the piston down, et cetera. We don't need to go into like the whole combustion cycle and everything right now, but that's the volume of displacement of the engine. In the mm-hmm. United States, we typically use a different measurement. We use cubic inch displacement, CID.
Right, because we're all about imperialism.
Yes, we use cubic inch.
Instead of metric.
But if you want to think of CC, the easiest way to think of like a CC displacement, you've heard the term like, you know, a 2-liter car, 3-liter engine, mm-hmm. 4-liter engine, whatever. It's typically about 1,000 cc's per liter.
Mm-hmm.
So a 1,000 cc engine is like a 1-liter engine. And if you want to put it that way. So like the old Mustang GTs that had a 5-liter engine, roughly about 5,000 cc's is what the displacement would be.
Gotcha. And to correct myself from earlier, I had said that I thought that the for a naturally aspirated, it was like 3,000 cc. It's actually 4,500 cc for that first race.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 4,500 cc limit on engine volume.
And this changes all the time.
All the time, which is why I was fumbling because it changes – like year to year, can change.
I have a real quick rundown of the changes, if you like, real quick.
I would love to hear this.
Super quick. So maybe we should talk about the current engine last, but pre-1989, it was unlimited cylinders. You could have as many cylinders as you want, 16 cylinders, 12 cylinders, whatever. Doesn't matter. In the 1990s, they switched this to 12 cylinders, and then in the early 2000s, they went to V10s.
Mm-hmm.
Then up until about 2008, they used V8s. And they have recently, this is in 2019, right now what they're using is a very specific, it's 1.6-liter 4-stroke turbocharged V6. So, you know, those incredible cars and the incredible speeds and sounds that we hear are coming from a turbocharged V6 that's relatively small. And they've been doing this since 2014. Again, just a 1.6-liter engine. So, that's 1,600 cc's, I guess, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah, and so this is also fascinating, is that you sit there and you look at this and you think, you know, what does this actually translate to, right? Mm-hmm. You're talking about engine volume.
Mm-hmm.
It is not necessarily equivalent to more CCs means more speed. It's all about other elements as well. Engineering as a whole takes a very important part in this. So that was another thing that was confusing to me because, all right, as a kid, I'm gonna really reveal my ignorance here. As a kid, to me, the exposure of the concept of CCs for engines was limited to games that involved go-kart racing video games.
Yeah, sure.
Because they would have the different, you know, you have a 50cc or a 100cc or 150cc. Mm-hmm. So to me, it was just like, bigger just means faster.
You know, that's typically the way it is, really. I mean, but somewhere along the way, you know, engineering got a whole lot better. Mm-hmm. And they're able to get so much more power out of a smaller engine. And that's what we're seeing here. I mean, we've gone from unlimited cylinders and, you know, 16-cylinder engines in these F1 cars down to, you know, turbocharged V6s.
Yeah.
And I don't know for sure, but I would say that they're going to continue to shrink in size.
Mm-hmm.
I just have a gut feeling they're going to just continue to get smaller and smaller.
Well, it's also interesting because just where we've seen the changes in the limitations for how big the engine is allowed to be, and then we've gotten to the point now where it's even it's uniform. That's saying, well, they all have to be specifically this particular engine volume. The other element that has changed quite a bit has been whether or not you could even have a turbocharged engine mm-hmm. in your vehicle. Some years it was, yes, you could either have a turbo engine of this capacity or naturally aspirated of this capacity.
Oh, so you could have, like, just for an example, you could have a turbocharged V6 or you could have a naturally aspirated V8.
Yeah. And then there were some years where they said, okay, well, now you can't have turbocharged at all.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time, it was really in the late 60s, early 70s, where that became a thing where they said, all right, we're going to remove turbocharged, largely because there seemed to be an unfair advantage of some of the vehicles that were engineered with turbocharged. They were giving the natural aspirated engines a chance to catch up in a way. This is something that we see from the governing body that I think they're constantly tweaking these rules in part because they want to have what they consider to be the most entertaining result, right? The most entertaining, most competitive race, because if it's not competitive, people start to lose interest. You know, you got to remember that the Formula One World Championship is actually a series of races. Mm-hmm. It's not one race. Winner take all.
No, it's 20 or I think it's 21 races.
It's
this
21
season.
Races in 2019.
Yeah, and they're all over the world.
Yeah, in fact, the United States only recently started to host them again, and it's in Austin, Texas, that where it takes place. And the reason why the United States, this is a whole different discussion, but it's largely because Formula One racing just never got super popular in the U.S.
Yeah,
which it was always seen as more of a European pursuit. Than an American one. Stock car racing was much more popular here.
You know, when I first moved to Detroit, this is back in the 1980s. This would have been like 84, 85, somewhere around there. They ran a Formula One race in downtown Detroit on the streets of Detroit. It was a road course that was on the streets of Detroit, and it was in such condition at the time that they were able to do that. And later they moved it out to Belle Isle, and they're still doing that now. But it's the CART IndyCar series. It's a different series. It's not the F1 guys like it was in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that pretty fascinating. It didn't last too long when I was there. I mean, I don't know how many years they ran there. I can't remember, but. I don't know. It's fascinating to me that, F1 just continually adjusts this. And I know it's maddening to the fans because they're always changing something around, making something different.
Mm-hmm.
And they're always trying to kind of level that playing field a little bit. And I know it's angering to us, as fans to watch this and kind of, try to keep up with the rule changes and what's happening in the series. I can't imagine what it would be like to be a team owner that has to adhere to these and have to pay for all the changes and everything. But, one other thing that this does is that it can lead to incredibly boring racing.
Mm-hmm.
If you get it too level, if you get everything too level. And that was a critique of F1 for a long, long time, and it's not this way anymore. It's different now. I've been watching this past season, even the season before, and it's quite a bit different now because of a lot of what we're going to talk about, some of the new technologies. But there was no passing. You'd start the race, and whatever order they would end up in, after turn one, turn two –
That was it.
That's how they finish.
Yeah.
And it was so boring for a long, long time.
So really, what mattered was how you qualified because your order of qualification determined your order in the starting for the race. And if you weren't in that, first place and after the second or third turn, well, you know what place you're going
to
get.
Yeah, a road course is very difficult to pass on. There's very few passing zones, for you to use to manipulate. It's gotten a lot better. If you haven't watched Formula One and that was your argument against it, it's a lot different now if you watch. And that is in relation to some of the technologies that we can talk about a little bit later because there are some advancements that have made the racing a lot more exciting for the fans to watch and a lot more exciting for the drivers, I'm sure. You don't finish in the order that you
started
in. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's a much better race now.
Yeah. And so at the end of the series of races, what they do is they have points given out to the top 10 finishers of each Grand Prix of each race. And then at the end of the season, those points are totaled up, and whoever has the most is the grand champion driver. But then you also have the winner teams.
Yeah, constructor championships.
Constructor championships. Mm-hmm. Where, yeah. And when you get to that point, if you're the company that is making the vehicle that is like sometimes you see like one company just dominating the top, sometimes top 10 teams, then that is where the value comes for that company. So, for example, Mercedes has been doing quite well in the last few years, and that ends up being a really valuable tool for them because, as we've said before, this really does help sell cars. If you're able to say, listen, we make the cars where the elite drivers, not just elite drivers who come from the same country that made the cars, but other elite drivers who they want to play, they want to drive for a winning team, they come to us. That's a powerful advertising tool.
Oh, sure is. Yeah. And you know what? As you mentioned, Mercedes, right now they are currently, as we're recording this, they're number one in the Constructors' Championship. Mm-hmm. And their driver, the driver is Lewis Hamilton. He's number one in the Drivers' Championship as well, obviously.
I mean, he's a Brit.
In Mercedes. Yeah, he is a Brit. And I think he's on his fifth title at this point, and Mercedes is also on their fifth title. They're very successful in the series, very successful. And as is, you know, you'll find that Ferrari and McLaren, you know, they all have their moments. You know, they all have it's kind of this up down thing, you know, like where one team does dominate the series, and you'll find that this switches around routinely, not necessarily throughout the season, because once you do find that, you know, someone is dominating the season, like I would bet that Lewis Hamilton's going to win his fair share of the next 10 races or however many are left as well, and Mercedes along with him, of course, and it'll probably just go the way you think it's going to go. But next year, who knows?
Yeah, from season to season, you got because you have so many people that are focusing on wringing out every single little drop of performance you can get out of these vehicles.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you're pairing them with the best drivers in the world who can endure the incredible amount of punishment they're going to have dealt upon them. I mean, if you look back at the history of Formula One racing and you want to look at stories of drivers who have gone through incredible trials and tribulations in the process of racing, there's no shortage of those stories. I remember coming across one of, there was a driver, I want to say he was something like 5'3" tall. This is from the classic days of racing, who was so determined to race. Ferrari was actually begging him to withdraw from a race because the car itself was starting to fall apart, and it was one of these road races from one city to another. And they were begging him to stop racing. He was racing on behalf of Ferrari, and he said, no, no, no. And Ferrari said, I was absolutely certain that his determination was to die behind the wheel doing what he loved. Turned out he ended up having to eventually withdraw from the race simply because the car couldn't perform anymore.
Sure, mechanical failure.
Yeah, he was, according to the stories, coughing up blood but still wanted to race.
Holy cow, really?
And he died in bed 5 years later. So it wasn't like he passed away immediately thereafter, but he was in failing health.
Oh my gosh.
And was still determined, and he was still winning too. He was 29 minutes ahead of the next fastest car.
That's significant distance.
Yes. So also shows you a lot of difference in between this and say NASCAR racing.
Sure.
And again, we're not trying to say one is better than the other, obviously. I know we keep saying that, but it's just to point out how different they are. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk about before we go to break is that the Formula One form factor is very distinctive, very different from the look of stock cars and other types of race cars.
Sure.
It's very low to the ground. It has almost sort of this very wing kind of design. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing to me is that it's a wing, but it's a wing that's meant to do the opposite of what an aircraft wing is doing.
Everything is about downforce. You want the car to stick to the ground. So the faster you go, the more it adheres to the ground. And of course, the tires are going to work with this as well. Mm-hmm. The whole car is really a giant wing, you're right, that provides downforce instead of lift.
Yeah.
And if you turn around, if you're going backwards in this thing, that's the unfortunate thing. You get into a turn and you spin around and you're going just as fast backwards. The problem is it becomes the opposite problem.
And it starts to lift the car off.
Yes. Wow. And that happens in a lot of forms of racing. You'll find that, you know, as soon as the car spins around, the back end wants to come straight up in the air on you. And that's an issue with any of these cars that, you know, downforce is a major part of the design. But yeah, you're right. It is. It's open wheel. It's open cockpit. That's changed just a tiny little bit, and I think they're going to go maybe even a little bit further with this idea, but that's the whole halo thing that we can talk about when we talk about technology. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting-looking car for sure. I mean, it looks like a spaceship, really.
Yeah.
I mean, they're getting to the point where there are so many facets and, surfaces, and every single bit of that car is engineered for speed and for its ability to cut through the air and to, again, provide downforce. We're talking about the tiniest little components behind the wheels. We're talking about the side pods that are next to the driver. I mean, every little bit of this thing is just tuned to perfection for it to be slippery through the air, to conserve fuel, to go fast, to be lightweight. You know, it's all these things.
And
every single factor is thought of, and everything is scrutinized to the point where if it doesn't belong, if it has no purpose, of course it's not going to be on the car.
Right.
If it has, if it does have a purpose, it's going to be made lighter somehow. It's going to be made more efficient somehow. Mm-hmm. It's going to be made of a stronger material, but a lighter material. It's going to be, slippery through the air, as we said. You know, every little thing is to the tiniest little minute detail is scrutinized by every single person on that team, and it makes for a fantastic vehicle.
Yeah.
And it gets better and better every year. The problem is then, you know, F1 will come back and say, like, we're going to make some changes.
Yeah.
And they change it.
Now your strategy is no longer applicable.
No. And you do have to change. And that change is something that has a domino effect. You change something at the front of the car. It not only affects that one little piece at the front of the car, it has this domino effect on the aerodynamics of the car all the way back to the tail end of it. And that has to be kind of dealt with.
So you end up having to do almost a total redesign every time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, not almost a total. I mean, not quite, but you have to refine so many different things just because of that one little change at the front of the car. And that happens, you know, they might change something in the middle of the car, and that affects everything from that point back. It's just there's so many things. Again, this whole series is mind-boggling. When you look at the rules, you look at the way everything, again, just has to be just gone over and over and over and over again to make sure that everything is perfect.
Man.
Well, and they are perfect.
When we come back, we're going to dive into that perfection a bit. We're going to talk a little bit more about stuff like I just learned before we came in here that they don't do refueling anymore, because when I was looking at the old histories, they talked about refueling and pit stops. We're going to talk about pit stops, talk about how much fuel these things carry, and you know, that will tell you how efficient they have to be in order to complete these distances, because the distance for Formula One is considerable. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about some of this incredible technology that you find in the vehicles of today when we come back.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, Scott, before we came into the studio, you know, we were talking about pit stops. I was actually talking about stuff I don't understand in racing. I was like, you know, I even had to look up how pit stops work because I know about pit stops. I know what they're meant to do. But I was thinking like, well, how does that work in the sense of the action of the race as a whole? Like you're obviously off the track at that moment. You're no longer accumulating laps. You're having your car having the tires usually replace that sort of thing. How does that work in the context of the full race? Not thinking, oh, wait, everybody else also has to do that. So in the end, it ends up being how fast and efficient your pit stop crew can be. That's when you said, why don't you take a look at like a typical Formula One pit stop? And the video, by the way, guys, was 55 seconds long. 10 seconds in, it was still just the title picture. There's no video. Around 12 seconds in, we saw the picture of the pit crew. We didn't see a car pull into the space till about 33 seconds into this 55-second video. The car was at a full stop by 35 seconds, and the car was gone at 38 seconds. Within that span of 35 seconds to 38 seconds, the pit crew completely removed and replaced all four tires on this Formula One race car.
And that's a relatively slow stop.
Yes, and then Scott blew my mind by telling me how fast the fastest Formula One pit stop ever was.
Which happened this year. I think, where was it? It was the Grand Prix in Great Britain?
I think you're right.
I can't remember exactly where it happened, but it was a 1.9 second stop. And that means four tires off, four tires on, and back out.
Yeah.
And it's that fast. It's 1.9 seconds. That's the world record time at this moment, and it's probably going to drop even more. But it's an incredible thing to watch. If you've never seen one, take a look at it because an F1 pit stop is a thing of beauty. It's choreographed.
It's terrifying.
It is so choreographed. It's so perfect in every aspect. I mean, the way that the team handles themselves, it's completely different from any other series in the way that they do this. Now we've taken out the complexity of adding fuel.
Yes,
that does take some time. Not as much time as you might think. To add sometimes 20 plus gallons of fuel to a car, it only takes a few seconds, really.
Yeah, when you compare that to your average experience at a typical fuel pump, you might think, when are we going to get that technology local gas station?
You don't want that technology. There's a lot of problems that come with forcing 20 plus gallons of fuel into a car in 3 seconds.
Yeah, you might think while you're standing there, I would really, especially if you're, say, outside in the Georgia heat in the middle of the day
refueling your car, you might think, I would really like to get back in the air conditioning. But some things we're happy to trade off on.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a lot easier. And they have just switched over to this. And I think they've done it for a couple of years now. They've removed the idea that they are refueling a car during the race. Mm-hmm. So you fuel up before the race and after the race. Of course, you know, during qualifying and, you know, other activities, practice, they're allowed to fuel in the pits, of course. They have to. But during the race, they just don't do it. The cars are designed so that they burn, or they're intended to burn, and that's one of the F1 regulations, is that your engine is only allowed to burn a certain amount of fuel per hour.
Right.
And they calculate that out so that, you know, during the race it doesn't burn more than what you're able to carry. Mm-hmm. And if it does, that means that your engine's running too rich anyway and you're not supposed to be doing that.
Right.
You're in violation of the rules. So every car that's out there has enough fuel in them from the very beginning to go the full distance without having to do that. They just do the tires only. And that's different right there. The other thing is that, you know, they have, like, I think it's 14 or 16 people out to do this procedure, this you know, stop.
Yes, it's a much larger pit crew than you would see in NASCAR, for example.
Yeah, everybody has just one single job. And I know that in NASCAR, you know, there's, you know, they're very specific jobs as well, or, you know, in IndyCar or whatever. But far fewer people are over the wall, as they say, in those mm-hmm. sports. Now, this one, there's a garage area. And so they just kind of wander out into this box, you know, where they pull in to do the pit stop. But
right.
14 or 16, I can't remember the number of people that do this, but, you know, when you have one job, I mean one job, all you do is, your job is to remove the tire that comes in off the car that was just on the track. Mm-hmm. That's it. Just take the tire off. Once the wheel nut is gone, which is another person's job, the wheel nut comes off, the wheel nut goes back on.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. And one person operates, of course, the front jack, the back jack. And, you know, there's people making adjustments and all that. But when you have – there's – what is it? Three, maybe even four people per tire. I think it's three per tire. It's
yes,
one to
you
take
have
it off.
One person who's bringing on the new tire. So they have the new tire. They're waiting. You have one person whose job it is to take the tire off, and then you have one person whose job it is to remove and replace the nut.
So just getting those three people in that one tiny little area to operate and function without, you know, knocking each other over every time.
Yeah.
It's incredible. It's really interesting to watch, and I can't imagine the countless hours they have to practice to make every single move perfect.
Right, right. You have to conserve your space, because if you're not, then you're wasting time.
No, if
right?
you make, if you make a pit stop that is even – let's say it's double – the time that we just talked about. Let's say it's 3.8 seconds. That's a disaster.
Yeah.
I mean, that's crazy to think about, but 3.8 seconds is a disaster.
Because you're going to have to make up that lost time. Someone else, even if you were in number one, if you're leading by less than 2 seconds and the person behind you, when they have their pit stop, is not taking nearly as long, you know, you've lost time.
Pit strategy is really something fun to watch. And I know that it sounds terribly boring when I just say it like this.
No,
you've got to
watch a video of these
guys. But when you're watching the race and you kind of get into it, you know, towards the end, and, you know, the pit strategy becomes so vital in winning a race in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm.
There's far more to it than you might think, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fascinating to watch. It's a game of chess.
We were talking a bit about the distance you have to go. So the last thing I saw about distances was that you would complete a number of laps that are equivalent – actually, that exceed 305 kilometers. So the minimum of a Grand Prix is 305 kilometers, with one exception, that exception being – Monaco.
Mm-hmm.
In Monaco, it is 260 and a half kilometers.
It's a tighter track there.
Yeah.
It's a smaller area, as you can imagine. Monaco is not a very large Providence? What is Monaco? I don't even –
it's
a principality?
To me, it's the most magical place on earth. I visited it, and it's amazing.
Oh, I bet it is. Yeah, I'd love to go.
It's beautiful.
I'd love to go. That'd be cool. Yeah. But it is very tight, and Monaco is a different race altogether.
Right. Well, and if you were to add another lap on there so that it would end up – you know, being closer to the correct distance, it would go too far. So mm-hmm. it's one of those where you have to, you know, you have to make a call.
Oh, sure.
And, but yeah, Monaco is pretty phenomenal. It's also, whenever I see footage of the race in Monaco, it is terrifying to me to watch these cars going down these roads. And sometimes you see people watching on, not terribly far away from where these cars are rushing by at more than 200 miles per hour.
Yeah, or they're on balconies kind of hanging over the track. Yeah. It's an interesting race. I love Monaco. It's beautiful, and it's fun to watch the race there because it is so it's steeped in history as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so tight and it's so fast, and you get that real sensation of speed there that you might not get. Well, you get it in a lot of road courses, but there's just something magical about Monaco. It's beautiful. It's really interesting. I don't know where to go with this. We've got so much material here. I don't know if I'm overstepping my bounds love to talk about the engine for just a moment.
Please.
If we can, because the engine – and we haven't talked about cost or anything on this yet. So – all right. I recently did a program on the Fast Track about why – there are five reasons why you can't put an F1 engine into your road car.
I want to hear this.
Because a lot of people have engine swap questions. And like you said before, you don't really know a whole lot about racing engines versus car engines. And they're dramatically different, especially an F1 engine. You can't just stuff an F1 engine into a road car and expect it to work. And there's a lot of reasons, probably 100 reasons why this wouldn't work. But the five, and I'm going to go through them super fast. If you want to hear it, I can plug my own show, right?
Yes,
you
absolutely.
You could go over to the Fast Track and listen to the five reasons explained in more detail. But the first one is they're really hard to start. Now, this is kind of tough to comprehend here, but a normal engine, you're able to attach a wrench to it in the front and spin the engine. You're able to make the pistons move up and down using a large lever. It does take some mechanical advantage to be able to do that, but you can spin your own car engine that way.
Okay.
It's a lot like turning the prop on an airplane.
Gotcha.
If you can imagine that. It's started. And you could theoretically turn it fast enough to start the car like the old crank starts, but don't want to do that.
Right.
So
I have a feeling you would end up quickly breaking every bone in your body as it starts spinning around.
Absolutely. And, you'd shatter your arms. With the F1 engine, it's a lot different. You cannot turn an F1 engine when it's cold. They are created with such a tight or high tolerance. They're engineered so precisely, like a fine watch or something like that. That, I mean, they're so precisely engineered and fitted together that the pistons are essentially seized in the engine at like the ambient temperature. So it doesn't matter what the temperature is out here. You have to use external pumps to pump heated fluids through this thing. You know, both coolant and the engine oil, the lubricant, and it has to be up to, I think it's 176 degrees Fahrenheit before you can even begin to move the pistons within the piston cylinders.
Wow.
That's how tightly they are engineered. They're such precision machines, and I had no idea that was a factor in this whole thing. So you would not be able to just get into the car and start it up like you could a normal engine. You would have to have these external pumps heat up the engine and then and then you would have to have an external starting unit, which is like a big drill that starts the whole thing. It spins at several thousand RPM in order to get it even going. And even then it's hard to start. It's difficult to get the fuel flowing correctly and all that. So
this is amazing. What it reminds me of is how you start up jet engines, because a jet – not that it works on the same principle. These are two different principles. Don't get me wrong. But to start a jet engine, you have to pump pressurized air through the jet engine, because it's designed to operate once you are at a certain speed moving through the air. Well, obviously on ground, you're not moving through the air yet.
No.
So you can't get those turbines turning at the proper speed for it to be a self-propelling reaction, right? This idea that the turbines turn because of the outgoing exhaust from the jet engine, that provides the turning force to keep the turbines coming to pull air through the engine. So you have to pump pressurized air into it first. And typically you do that either using an auxiliary power unit, or you have the little huffer carts hook up to an engine. So to me, like, when you started explaining this, I'm like, wow, this sounds a lot like how it's hard to start a jet engine. It's just that we're talking about an internal combustion engine, not a jet engine, obviously. So there are differences.
No, there are differences, but that's fascinating. You have to have these external factors in order to begin the thing, to even start the process, and that's what this is.
All right, I'm just going to tap the brakes here so that we can take one more, break for ads, and then we're going to be back with the conclusion of Formula One 101.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. on the network that covers more roads than any other carrier. Take your work on the road, and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI. And Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As you might have guessed, they're not cheap. And this is the first time we're going to really talk about prices here on this. I think this is the first time. Get this.
Okay.
And this blew me away.
Yeah.
I'm talking about just the engine, just the price of the engine. These range between $7.7 million and $10.5 million per engine.
Just the engine.
For just the engine.
Another good reason why you weren't going to put these in a regular road car.
Just one engine. That's all we're talking about. So, yeah, even – I mean, any manufacturer would never be able to justify putting an engine like this in their car. Now, there are some derivatives of an F1 engine that have kind of showed up into road cars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like maybe the V10 engine that was used in an F1 car, but it's not, you know, meticulous. It's not as finely tuned. It's not as, you know, it doesn't have all of the components of
right.
an F1 engine, of course. It's just derived from it.
Right. And it's the design of the F1 informed the design of this other engine.
Exactly. And these F1 engines, they spin at something like 15,000 RPMs. They can go up to 20,000 RPMs, which is like, I mean, that's motorcycle or even faster RPMs in an engine for a race car.
Yeah, if you saw that gauge on your dashboard, you might flip out a bit.
This next one is what you're talking about. It's cooling.
Mm-hmm.
In order to keep these engines cool, you would have to travel at such incredible rates of speed. And not only that, the design of your car would have to be so dramatically different from what it is that you would have to build these enormous side pods on it with these huge radiators, and that would kind of like negate any performance advantage you might have from such a strong engine. You're gonna have such a wacky design, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Better, less, lack of good way to say this.
Just to dissipate the heat that's coming off that engine.
Those enormous side pods on the car, the ones that are next to the driver, those are big cooling pods. And think of those as having giant radiators inside them that are laid out at kind of a 45-degree angle from the front, kind of laid down to the back. They're really big. They're several feet long, and they're extremely as wide as they can make them, really. Mm-hmm. And that requires so much airflow over top of them to keep it cool, because these engines run so hot that you just would – it just – wouldn't be possible to keep the amount of incoming cool air that you would need to keep the engine cool.
Gotcha.
In a regular road car.
Right.
And without dramatically redesigning everything. We did talk about fuel a little bit, and I want to tell you that these are designed – you're not allowed to burn through more than 100 liters of petrol per hour of driving. So that's the limit, is 100 liters per hour. That's about 13.2 gallons of fuel if you want to extrapolate what that 100 liters amounts to.
Mm-hmm.
They do carry around 225 liters for a race though. So that's a lot of fuel that they're carrying on board for
yeah.
these things. So they do get through the whole race without refueling. That's about 60 gallons of fuel that they carry.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the race, they're probably running pretty low if I had to guess.
Yeah. Because it's like the time limit at max, assuming there are no red flag stoppages,
yeah.
is 2 hours.
And this is surprising to me. The fuel mixture that they use
mm-hmm.
is not terribly different from what you might use in a road car.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
strange. Now, you might think that, they're using some kind of crazy jet fuel or something. You know, like people love to think that, they're using rocket fuel or something. It's really not that much different from what we use. It is formulated a little different. It's very specific per vehicle. And I'll tell you how they do that. At the end of the race, they analyze the oil. They take the engine oil from each car mm-hmm. and they take a sample of it and they run it to their chemist. And their chemist looks at it for up to 15 different types of metal that might be found in that oil at the end of a race. So that indicates where the wear is coming from. So
mm-hmm.
Part of an engine is wearing a little bit prematurely, causing metal flakes to break off and get into the oil. They know where that metal came from because it might be the piston ring, it might be the piston itself, it might be from the camshaft, whatever bearings they have in there. They're able to determine from the 15 different types of metal where that wear is coming from, and then they send that information to the person who is developing the fuel for them, or the company that's developing the fuel, and then they specially formulate the fuel for the next race in order to minimize the amount of wear that happens
at that one part of the engine.
In the next race, yes.
Wow.
Yes, so that's how specific this gets, and you can imagine that's not cheap to do that.
Yeah. Now, there was a time before the formalization of these rules where there was a little bit more experimentation with mm-hmm. with car fuels, and that's probably where these stories about rocket fuel and stuff come out of, largely from also Germany. Pre-World War II happened. they experimented a lot with that.
Yeah.
But then there were rules that essentially said that Formula One race cars were to run on petrol. It's very precisely formulated
sure.
petrol.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very exacting science. So it's not exactly what we're thinking of when we go to the pump.
Yeah. You're not hitting 87, 89 or Formula One.
No, it's not quite that simple. I'm sure there are exact requirements for each one. And then even then, they fine-tune it throughout the season.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely fine-tuned. The last one on this is, of course, the lifespan of the engine. Now, we've all seen races where a car goes out and two laps in, they develop some major problem. And,
right.
After all this money, all this – everything we've talked about, they're 10 miles into the race and there's catastrophic engine failure.
Yeah.
Because they're subjected to so much pressure, so much force is happening mm-hmm. in these engines at this time. Yeah, I mean, we're saying that, they spin around, 20,000 RPM? That means that the pistons are traveling up and down about 300 times every second.
It's so incredible.
Yeah, 300 times every single second. So that's the type of pressures that we're talking about. I mean, we're saying I want to say it's like 15,000 or 1,500 PSI is what those cylinders are subjected to every second.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of pressure in these things. And, of course, they have to be rebuilt all the time. And we know this from racing. We've seen this in so many different mm-hmm. series. Drag racing, they practically do it every quarter mile.
Yeah.
They rebuild engines all the time, right? Or even less if it doesn't make it a quarter mile. But most race cars can only last one, maybe two races at the most before mm-hmm. they have to be rebuilt. These are every race. And the maximum that they can reach is about maybe two races at the most. Like 621 miles, it's about 1,000 kilometers is like the maximum life at optimal conditions for mm-hmm. an F1 engine, which means that if you were to put one of these into your road car,
wow.
Think about, many.
Not only is it $7 to $12 million, but $7 to $12 million every.
This many times. And I'll tell you. So the average U.S. person puts 13,476 miles on a car every year. That's average if you own a vehicle. That means that you would be rebuilding your engine 22 times each year. If you were average. Now, a lot of people, of course, are going to be way above that average.
Sure.
A lot of people are going to be under. But 22 times per year, you're spending $7.5 to $10.5 million. So
I'm going to need to sell some more Girl Scout cookies.
Do you see what I mean? Like, and, yeah. and I, again, if you want more detail on all this, and maybe you don't, maybe that was way too much to be.
No, it's not.
But if you go on, if you want more detail on this, you can go to the Fast Track show and listen all about it. But I find the numbers in Formula One to be just fascinating. And
yeah.
The dollar amounts and should we just briefly talk about the car?
Yeah, because we started it with the engines. Let's talk about how expensive this kind of vehicle is when you're looking at it soup to nuts. And then we'll also talk about – I mean, you can also mention things like that's one expense, right?
Yeah.
One expense is just the vehicle. Mm-hmm. But then beyond that, you have to actually pay money to be part of this whole experience. So there are companies that are spending – mind-boggling amounts of money on participating in Formula One.
Yeah, and so for some of the smaller teams, if you want to call them that, the ones that aren't in the upper echelon, they're spending right around $250 million a year to be part of F1 for one season.
So a quarter of $1 billion per year.
Yeah,
and to be in this.
And if you're you happen to be working for you know Ferrari, McLaren, Mercedes, Red Bull, you know the top teams in the series right now, we're talking about $400+ million every single year. And a lot of that, of course, goes into the car. It takes you know between I see a number here that's a little bit low, given that we just learned that you know the engine is $10.5 million. Sometimes I'm going to say that anywhere between $12 and $15 million per vehicle per car. So when you see, you know, an F1 car that's destroyed in an accident on the track, you're talking about a you know, between $12 and $15 million loss to the team.
Yikes.
They might be able to salvage a few parts here and there, but essentially it's a $12 to $15 million loss at that point. Of course, that doesn't happen often where they lose every single bit of the car.
Sure.
But they do lose parts. And I've got a list here of the parts, and I will not go over every part of this, but this kind of blew my mind when I saw this. You know, how often do you see where an F1 car goes on the track and they hit a little bit of debris,
yeah.
you know, something, not a tire necessarily, but something that's on the track.
Mm-hmm.
They bump a corner or whatever, another car even. You know, that front wing is designed to come right off and right back on. They do it super quick. They can do it in a second, 2 seconds, whatever it takes. It's super fast. That part, that front wing part, can cost anywhere between $150,000 to $235,000.
Scott, I'm beginning to feel like I'm in the wrong business.
I mean, tires.
I can make like 2 wings a year and be living like a king.
You know, the thing, like, okay, I'm gonna wrap up with another one in a moment here because I want to show you something in specific. But if the transmission in the car, we talked about the engine already. The transmission in the car can be up to $600,000. You know, if you're on a lower end team, you're only paying only about $400,000 for that. But if you want to upgrade, you know, you're going to have a $600,000 engine. That's for the top teams again. The fuel tank alone, just because of the way it's designed. And what the material it's made of, $140,000, and that's kind of again a low end tank. The carbon fiber monocoque design, you know, which is essential to the safety of the driver and the structure of the car itself, that's very expensive, and teams won't scrimp on that. There are lower cost options, I believe, but most teams are paying around $650,000 for that. And of course, once it's damaged, it's done. You don't get to reuse that. That has to be replaced. As is with most of these parts. There's the halo device, which is that crazy thing that goes over their heads now.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of blocks in the it protects the exposed helmet and head of the driver.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that I wish we had more time to talk about, really. It's a pretty fascinating piece of tech that that I just love the tech that goes into these cars.
Yeah.
I really do. There's that is it's designed to hold the weight of a double-decker bus, a London double-decker bus. If you were to just set it on top of it, I think it's like 26,500 pounds.
Wow.
It can withstand that. And it's designed, again, like if a tire is coming at the driver, if it's an outside company that builds it, they build kind of like the it's made out of I have a note here. It's made out of like platinum, I think.
That's not cheap.
No, it's not cheap. And you know, I do have a note. I'll find it here in just a moment. But it's like a certain aerospace grade platinum level 5 something. It's crazy. It's really really expensive, and it's kind of a heavy item. But it's essential for their safety because it is this open cockpit, and they have had so many Incidents where a tire has come up or a piece of suspension or a full car, you know, has come up and landed on the other vehicle. And of course, you know, with your helmet and your head exposed there, it's a really dangerous type of racing, this open cockpit.
I mean, that's been part of the Formula One history too, is the fact that it's been a very dangerous sport. One in which in the early years of Formula One racing, not a whole lot of thought was given to driver safety necessarily. It was, it was kind of like the space race in many ways, in that it was thought that if you were the type of person to pursue a career in that space, you were a thrill seeker, and it was the importance of racing and going fast was more important than doing safety features. Like, you have astronauts, you can listen to interviews with astronauts about, well, do you worry about like how dangerous this is? It's like, I feel compelled to do this. Mm-hmm. And the same thing was sort of thought of in the old racing days, was that, yeah, you know, safety would be great and all, but that's not what we're worried about.
Well, you know, I can tell you now, I found this note. It is the strongest part of the car, and that shows you, it tells you how much they're, firmly backing this idea that driver safety is becoming more and more and more important as the decades progress in Formula One. And in the 60s, they were a little bit more lax with that type of thing, and that's why drivers like Jackie Stewart and several others other names that you would recognize, they protested, they sat out races, they didn't race in certain places because they were losing friends every month.
Yeah, the reason why we saw changes was largely because the drivers and the races were starting to demand changes.
Yeah, the cars were getting so fast, and the tracks were so fast, and the safety standards just weren't there. They just weren't protecting the drivers the way that they should. And Jackie Stewart realized this, and several other racers did as well. There's a lot of information out there on Jackie Stewart and what he did to push safety forward in Formula One, and it's a huge leap forward for the drivers and the safety and just kind of their overall well-being, I guess. And I found this note about the halo, and I'm sorry, I think I said, did I say platinum? I hope I didn't say platinum when I said what material it was.
I won't tell you that you said platinum.
It's a mandatory device, obviously. It's aerospace industry grade 5 titanium.
Oh, titanium. That makes much more sense.
Yeah, it probably does, yeah. But it can withstand the weight of that London double-decker bus, which is like 26,500 pounds.
That's incredible.
It is incredible. It is the strongest part of the car at this point. And again, that's a nod to safety. Another piece of tech, a couple pieces of tech that finally we're getting to tech, right? Tech
stuff.
You know, they have biometric gloves that the drivers wear now? I don't know if you knew this or not.
No,
we didn't
talk
about this, but the drivers wear biometric gloves, and this is actually a safety feature because it facilitates the medical response to the driver when they're, if there's a medical situation that's happening and the driver doesn't even really know what's happening yet, it registers in these gloves with pulse rate. It's also got the oxygen level in your blood.
Oh, okay.
Level. It measures that, but it will tell them as they approach the vehicle, if it's been in an accident, the driver's condition and what to look for. They'll know pretty much exactly what's going on with that driver at that point, whether they've got a pulse, whether they don't. Unfortunately, a lot of times they don't. I mean, these wrecks are pretty severe when they do happen.
Yeah, but you're going at incredible speeds in a vehicle that's still, even with the added safety features, its very design is one that you could easily see there'd be some pretty catastrophic injuries if there is a crash.
And I didn't mean to step over your discussion about the space race and the astronauts and how they – I mean, but these guys, they know going into this, just like the astronauts, they know going into this that they're in it for the whole thing. It's either it's all or none for them.
Yeah.
And there's always that chance every single time. And it's not being overly dramatic. It's true. Every single time they get into that car, it could be the last time they get into that car.
Yeah.
And they know it. And as do the astronauts, they know it. They know what they're in for. But they knowingly take the risk because, the reward for them is so great that they decide that, this is something I want to do and I want to dedicate my life to this, really.
So they've got these biometric gloves. One of the things that I've also noticed about Formula One race cars is the steering mechanism is very different from what you would see in a standard vehicle.
Have you been peeking at my notes?
No, I'm just thinking about pictures I've seen of these crazy steering mechanisms.
Do you remember early on when we sat down and I said, I'm going to turn this piece of paper over on the desk here so you can't see what it is? That is what it is. It's okay. A steering wheel. And I don't know what's more complex, my notes around the steering wheel or the steering wheel itself. But the steering wheel in a Formula One car is incredibly complex.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I've watched a lot of videos about this, and the buttons really do make sense when you have a driver describe to you what they are.
Right. So if you were to look at a picture of this, because, you know, obviously this being an audio podcast, you aren't given the benefit of what Scott just showed me, which was a picture of this. It looks kind of like a video game controller in a way.
Yeah.
Right? It's calling it a wheel seems like it would be misdirection, because it's not a full wheel shape. Hmm. You've got the little bit of the wheel on the left and right sides, but it really does look kind of like a video game controller, almost like it has a screen in the front. It's got some dials and some buttons that are in easy reach of your hand placement. I see now that there are clutch buttons on the wheel itself, mm-hmm. which is interesting. I have no idea what the rest of these things do. So tell me a little bit about this.
I'll make it quick because there's way too much to cover here. This is its own podcast, really.
Yeah.
The tech that's involved in a Formula One steering wheel is unbelievable. There are videos about this. There's a lot of online articles about it. And in fact, I will tell you that the price of the steering wheel, mm-hmm. It probably would not surprise you to hear that this is expensive as well. Between $50,000 and $100,000 per wheel. Now, a lot of racers, a lot of drivers for each car will have up to three different wheels. They'll have a primary wheel that they normally use. They'll have a backup, you know, just in case something happens, you know, during an accident or whatever, you know, practice or just malfunctions. And then they'll also have a lot of times an experimental wheel that then loads on new buttons, has new systems, new settings, that type of thing. So the buttons do different things. And it's less complicated than you might think. I mean, when you're looking at it, it's extremely complicated. But the drivers learn this very quickly. They understand every single function of it, and it's all within reach, and it's all customized to them. The hand grips are customized. They're formed mm-hmm. to their hands, so they fit exactly in their hand. It's not a one-size-fits-all thing. They're all different shapes. They're all different sizes, and the buttons are essentially the same. I mean, I'm not going to go through every single one again, but, you know, there's like a radio button, as you might expect. There's a neutral and reverse button for the car, so you don't inadvertently run over your crew as you pull into the pit. You know, you can get mm-hmm. in neutral. There's the pit lane speed limiter, which is limited to either 80 kilometers per hour or 60, depending on the track mm-hmm. and how much space you have. Each track has its own pit lane speed. There's a button for something called the drag reduction system, which we haven't even talked about. But drag reduction system is a like movable aerodynamic wing on the back of the car.
So it's like the elements you would see on an aircraft.
Yes.
It's like the flight surfaces on wings and tails of aircraft.
Yes, and you can reduce your drag by pushing this button. And there are certain parameters where a driver is allowed to do that, but it's controlled by the driver with a button on this wheel. Mm. And it's just the flap on the rear wing that gives you an aerodynamic advantage in order to pass the car that's in front of you. And you have, again, the parameters are like certain zones on the track that you're able to use this. And I think you have to be within 1 second of the car in front of you in order to push the button. One second following speed. Now, I guess that's up to, you know, F1 rulemakers, you know, exactly how close you were when you used this. But it does give you an advantage, and it promotes passing. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things they've done to make it a little more exciting. There are differential settings that are for entry and exit of turns. And this changes the balance of the car while you're driving it.
Wow.
So you can kind of promote, additional oversteer, additional understeer, whatever you like. You can kind of fine tune the car as you're driving it. There are, of course, you know, there's clutch operation for gear shifts, of course. That's what you saw earlier. There's mm-hmm. paddles on both sides, up and down. There's an overtake button. There's messaging buttons. There's an energy recovery harvesting button, which means
right.
You know, you can gain that little extra boost of power if you need it for passing.
Right. There's the button to listen to your favorite iHeartRadio podcasts. There's that one.
Yeah,
the one that has a little heart on it.
The most confusing – yeah, that's right. That's funny. the most confusing ones to me are the dials. There are dials at the bottom that have, you know, like tire presets or chassis presets.
Wow.
And you can kind of fine-tune the chassis that way, but it's not just a button. The driver has to remove his hands from the wheel, his biometric glove from mm-hmm. the wheel, and fine-tune the chassis and the tires and, you know, all this. It's just – it's a fascinating – feature to this whole thing, and you can control so much from it. I can understand why it's expensive, but
yeah.
I don't know, $50,000 expensive?
That's the price of a car. That's just that wheel.
Get up to $100,000, that's the price of a small house.
Yeah.
You know, and they need three per vehicle. I mean, it's
incredible.
The prices are just insane, but I love the series mm-hmm. overall. I think, as you've been able to tell, I've gone on and on here for probably far too long. But I'm a big Formula One fan. I hadn't watched it for a long time. I kind of got back into it last season. And the problem here in the United States is that oftentimes the races, because they're being held many times over in Europe,
yeah.
They might start at, you know, 6 in the morning here.
Yeah.
You know, when it's like a midday race there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes it a little difficult to watch unless you're recording it. And,
right.
And I have in the past recorded them. Yeah, but if I happen to be up on Sunday morning at 6 a.m., usually that's what's on my screen.
It's pretty cool. I mean, like I said, just the watching the videos that I've seen, it really does bring together that necessary combination of incredible engineering and technology and amazing, like, laser focus yeah. for everybody involved on that team, whether it's the driver or the crew. It's phenomenal how synchronized everything has to be in order to wring out every thousandth of a second you can, because that could be the difference between coming in first or second.
Sure. And, you know, we are – I think we say this every time, or at least I do on my show anyways. This is kind of the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
There is so much tech that is crammed into these cars. There are entire sections on the F1 site. If you go to F1.com,
mm-hmm.
you can look up just the technical information and just the technical advantages that have been created or fine-tuned just this year by certain teams.
Yeah.
And you can go back in different years. You can look at 2018's upgrades and 2017's, and you can look at historical documents. And there's so much information available on the series, and it's just, again, if you're a tech person, and I would guess that you would be listening to this podcast, there is more tech here than you can imagine. It's just, it's a fascinating series.
It is amazing. It is amazing. Now, there's a couple things I want to say before we sign off. One of those is that I did mention I was going to briefly explain the difference between Formula One and Formula Two racing. The biggest difference is that in Formula Two racing, every team is racing with the same car, essentially, the same mm-hmm. basic type of vehicle and engine. So there's no differentiation there. And the idea is to create a more level playing field and also to reduce the cost of entry. And if you go to Formula Three and Formula Four, as you go up the numbers, then you'll see that the barrier to enter is slightly lower.
Yeah.
By lower, I mean it's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars instead of the millions of dollars. So it's so your mileage may vary.
You're not buying a $10.5 million engine for your Formula 4 car.
Yeah. So it's also kind of – it becomes sort of almost a league, a farm league
yeah.
for future Formula 1 drivers. There's only so many Formula 1 drivers who are allowed to participate per year.
Yeah. So F1 scouts, not only will they go to other series and look for F1 drivers, people that are talented in their own series, whether that's it could even be NASCAR, it could be IndyCar, CART, mm-hmm. could be any of those series. But they often will go to, you know, the Formula 2 series and take a look at, you know, who's the young rising star
right.
in that series.
Right. And maybe we try them out and add them to the team next season for the Formula One team.
Yeah, here are the keys. Well, I guess not keys, but here's the
yeah.
let's just say it that way anyway. Here are the keys to the $15 million car.
Yeah.
Don't wreck it, Junior.
Don't get a scratch on the paint, please.
Yeah. I don't think there are any F1 drivers that are named Junior.
Probably not.
Lots of NASCAR drivers.
A lot of juniors over in NASCAR, yeah. You know, maybe you'll have a lot of the thirds. Yeah, that was one of the things. The other thing I wanted to mention was that, we kind of toyed around a little bit in the history of Grand Prix racing. But that's something that you and Ben covered at great length in a previous episode of Car Stuff.
Absolutely.
And I wanted people to be aware of that because this is an incredibly rich and fascinating history. It's full of drama, not just in the races, but in just the progression, the evolution of the sport. And do you have that episode?
I do. And you know what? There might even be drama in the podcast. I'm not sure.
I mean, it's Ben. He's sort of a drama queen.
No, between Ben and I, there might be a little bit of drama. You never know. But we did actually a two-part series on this. We did How Formula One Works. So if you search How Formula One Works on CarStuffShow.com in the search box up there, you will find back in May of 2013, we did that two-part series. Mm-hmm. And it's roughly, you know, I think they're about 40, 45 minutes each.
Yeah.
And I think it's a pretty good look back at Grand Prix racing and then, of course, Formula One and some of the players and some of the rules. And, and of course, now we're 6 years beyond this.
Yeah.
So, you know, what we're talking about right now is a little bit different than what it was back then. But essentially, the history is never going to change, obviously.
Right,
so
right.
You're going to get a full story there if you want to go back and look at that. And
awesome.
Thank you for referring to them.
Absolutely.
Always use some more views on that one, right?
Yeah. You know, it never hurts to get that download number popping up a couple of months. It feels good.
Yeah, why not? This has been fun.
But yeah, it's also, I mean, it's to nail this home, I mean, we know that in 2020, it'll be different from 2019. Like, there'll be different rules that'll come into play, and it'll end up putting teams in a scramble to get everything finely tuned, and we'll see that progression happen throughout the season as well.
I know the fans are already talking, you know, 2020, 2021, they're talking about rules and potential rules and, you know, what that's going to mean. And fans love to talk about this stuff and, you know, to argue about it. It's actually kind of fun to get into the forums and read about some of this stuff or just, you know, to kind of lurk there in the background and watch what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, and here as a baseball fan, I thought, just getting into arguments about the designated hitter rule is passionate. I got nothing on race car fans.
they do get passionate. They get intense.
They do. They get intense. That's a good word for it. And maybe we'll even do a deeper dive on tech in Formula One in the near future, kind of really dive into some of this stuff a bit more. But I felt like for the first episode, it was more important to get kind of that general overview. Like, obviously, like, we've been going on for a while. We could go on for another 2 hours just about the tech. And so, Scott, I may tap on your shoulder one day and say, hey, how about we go in and finish what we started?
Oh, perfectly fine. And I hope I didn't stretch your show out too long here. I
mean, I'm fine with it. Tari's the one who's, you know, she's the one who's yelling at me.
Yeah, she's ready to go home.
Yeah.
I've got a lot to say about the series, as you can tell. I've been an open wheel racing fan my whole life. I love IndyCar. Formula One, a little bit less than IndyCar, but I'm still a big fan, as you can tell. And it's all fascinating to me. I could talk for hours about this stuff. I really could. And I think you and I just have kind of a good rapport. I think
we're
able to go back and forth with this stuff pretty good. We have conversations like this at our desk all the time.
Absolutely. That's why I was like, I need to get Scott back into the studio. And then Michael tweeted me and was saying, hey, where's that Formula One podcast you promised me ages ago? And I thought, this is the perfect opportunity.
Well, Michael, I appreciate it too, because I love to get into the studio and talk about this stuff. It's fun.
Yeah, it was great. And we'll come back to this in a future episode, and we will cover more about the space age technology that are in these vehicles and how that, again, helps contribute to the amazing performance we see.
How about how titanium is not platinum?
Listen, Scott, if we want to go down a list of things that have been said on this podcast that turned out to not be 100% accurate, we're going to be here for a very long time, because I've been doing this for more than 1,000 episodes, and I make a gaffe at least once a show.
Oh, perfectly fine. I think that's acceptable.
Yeah, no, we're well under the threshold. We're fine.
Great.
I hope you enjoyed that classic episode of Tech Stuff from 3 whole years ago. Not even 3 yet. But also, shout out to Scott and love sent through the universe to him. I hope he's doing well. Miss you, buddy. And I hope you all enjoyed this episode. If you have suggestions for topics I should tackle on future episodes, a lot of people have been reaching out with some great suggestions, and I am working on those ideas, so that will be coming up. But if you would like to be one of those folks, reach out to me on Twitter. The show's handle is TechStuffHSW, and I'll talk to you again really soon. Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Badatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.